come back any more. And if he made a plan, who knew what was possible?
And yet, he couldn't deny recent events and how his life had been changed.
Maybe there was a plan. Just not his.
If you leave, I'll go with you, Malcolm said. And if you stay, I'll stay.
Wraith sat up and leaned in.
Why?
The way I see it, each of us is all the other one has at the moment. You don't have a clan or family, and neither do I. We're sort of our own clan, the two of us. And you've done well by me. I'm still alive after all, and I have this wonderful spear now.
He thumped the butt against the dirt.
Do you think they'll let me keep it?
After that throw, they have to. Quite impressive, by the way. You nearly killed him.
Malcolm replied with an awkward smile. Actually, I wasn't trying to hit him.
Seriously? Wraith said, even more impressed. You meant to just miss him like that?
Yeah. Except I was aiming 5 feet to his right.
The spear hit inches to his left.
Malcolm smiled and nodded again.
Still impressed.
More than ever.
Wraith grinned. You know, once a man uses a weapon in battle, and if he survives, then the weapon bonds to him and becomes his.
Malcolm looked up at the spear towering over them and smiled.
Then maybe I should name it. People do that, right?
Some do.
Okay. I'll call it Nasir Abad.
Excellent name. Very fierce-sounding.
Is it a Frey word?
Malcolm nodded.
What does it mean?
Malcolm smiled.
Pointy.
Wraith laughed, and Malcolm joined him. It felt good to laugh. It felt good to breathe the morning air and feel the heat of the sun on his face. And it felt good to sit beside Malcolm, as if they didn't have a care in the world.
Maybe they didn't. There wasn't any point in worrying about tomorrow. No one knew what it held. Maybe nothing at all.
What do you think I should do, Malcolm, my clansman? You probably understood everything they said, right? I only caught phrases here and there, but it sounded like this might not be over.
No, Malcolm said. Just beginning, I should think.
Cocking his head at Wraith and firming his mouth, he appeared to be giving the question his full thought and attention. He glanced at the sky, drew up his knees, and rubbed his chin.
When faced with certain death, running is sensible. But I think a man can make an unhealthy habit of it. Running can take on an importance of its own and become an excuse to avoid living a normal life.
What's a normal life?
I was a slave. How should I know? I just don't think a person should give up trying to find out.
Wraith looked over at Persephone again.
She was crying, wiping her cheeks with the palms of her hands. Their eyes met, and she sent him an embarrassed smile.
We're going to stay, Malcolm.
Malcolm followed his stare.
I had a feeling we might. You like her, don't you?
She's different.
Everyone is different.
Then let's say I like the ways in which she's different. A wise man once told me no man can escape death, but it's how we run that defines us. And if I have to run, I think I'd like to go where she's going.
It began in the late afternoon. The dead had been buried, and the worst parts of the mess cleaned up. Doing so had put the ground back under people's feet, and by early evening, as the sun dipped toward the tops of the crescent forest, it was clear to everyone that the world hadn't ended. As the news of Conniger's death circulated, it also became clear they were leaderless and in peril. Thoughts became whispers, which soon turned into questions. Sarah, Bryn, Delwyn and Moya approached Persephone as she stood looking at the murky crater in the middle of the Dal, wondering what could be done about it. They would need to fill it in if they were to reuse the land. But where would they haul the dirt from? And was filling it the best choice? Perhaps they could use the pit for additional storage. "This is going to be a problem," Persephone told them as they came up to her. Sarah, who led the group, didn't say a thing. She simply walked over and hugged her. Behind them, Roan watched from a distance.
"Seth, what are we going to do now?"
Sarah whispered in her ear.
"We don't have a chieftain, or a shield, and no keeper of ways."
Delwyn nodded.
"We thought maybe you might have some idea. I mean, this hasn't happened before, has it? Reglan was chieftain for 40 years, and his father ruled for nearly as long before him. We've always... we've usually just gone father to son. But Reglan's died, and Conniger never had any..."
"Delwyn!" Sarah snapped. "In the grandmother's name! Show a little compassion, would you?"
"I'm sorry, I..."
"It's fine," Persephone said, offering a forgiving smile.
"It's just that..."
Delwyn said, lowering his voice as if the next part were a secret. "Bryn tells us that in cases where there is no clear successor, like a son or a shield, the Keeper of Ways is expected to administrate and oversee combat challenges for the first chair. But Maeve is dead."
"We're afraid of what might happen," Sarah said. "Some of the younger men are already sizing each other up."
"She's right," Delwyn nodded, agreeing with his wife. "Without a keeper, fellows like Tope's sons and Whedon's sons are picking sides. We could have an inter-clan war on our hands if something isn't done."
"We've had enough bloodshed,"
Sarah said with a pleading in her voice and eyes.
"We don't need any more."
"And I sure don't want to see Tressa in charge," Moya said.
"Where is Tressa?" Persephone asked.
"Over at Bergen's," Moya said. "She's pretty drunk."
Persephone nodded.
"So, do you know what we're supposed to do?"
Delwyn asked.
Persephone nodded. "Of course I do."
Her words and matter-of-fact tone took all of them by surprise, causing their smiles and looks of relief to be delayed.
"Come on, let me show you," Persephone said.
Taking Sarah's hand and Marth's spear, she led them to the steps of the lodge. Persephone let go of Sarah and climbed to the porch, then turned to face the doll.
"You've all been hearing a lot of rumors about what happened last night, and you all saw what happened today."
She spoke in a loud, clear voice. It didn't take long for people to notice. The lodge steps had always been the altar of the chieftain, the pulpit where he addressed the doll. Hearing her speak formally while holding that black spear, those who weren't already on their way rushed over.
"Conniger is dead," she said. "So is Maeve. They were both killed last night by the great brown bear that has been terrorizing this doll. They, and many others, died. We mourn their passing, but let us be cheerful that the bear is at last dead."
With the growing quiet, her voice carried farther, and people from outside the walls and inside their homes came crowding around, gathering before the steps.
"Some have asked, who will lead us? The answer is simple. I will."
Moya began clapping, a great smile spreading across her face. No one else joined her.
"How can a woman be chieftain?" Cobb asked.
"How? Cobb, I've practically been chieftain for nearly 20 years.
There wasn't a major decision Reglan made that we didn't discuss together before he ordered it. And who was it that brought the Godkiller to us and welcomed the Frey when they arrived?
Who took measures to save Arion's life? The Frey, who just saved all of ours?
And who was it that called everyone into battle this morning? She raised the black spear over her head to remind them.
What about the ways? Galston asked.
Bryn, do the ways of succession, as taught to you by Maeve, prohibit a woman from sitting in the first chair?
Bryn stepped forward. She looked back at her parents just briefly, and then said,
No, Mom.
Persephone smiled at the sudden honorific.
But we'll need a warrior to lead us, Angleton said. Not a woman.
If there is anyone who doesn't want me as their leader, they have the right to challenge. That's also in the ways, isn't it, Bryn?
She nodded and, with a poke from her mother, lifted her head and said,
Yes, yes it is.
Of course, according to the ways, I have a right to name a champion. Isn't that so, Bryn?
Yes, Mom.
Wraith?
Persephone looked to where he stood beside Malcolm near Roan's house.
Would you please act as my champion?
Absolutely, he replied. But in all honesty, you don't need me.
Wraith turned so that everyone could hear him. Persephone left out one important detail about what happened last night. That bear, the one that has terrorized this Dáil and killed so many of your men, including the last two chieftains.
He nodded toward Persephone.
She killed it.
Eyes shifted between the two, clouded in disbelief and confusion.
It's true, Wraith insisted. She killed that big brown monster all by herself, with no one's help.
No one at all. And she didn't even need a spear or a sword.
How then?
Moya asked, astounded. Wraith waited a second, then said,
She beat it to death with the edge of a shield.
Dáil Ren filled with murmurs.
With a shield? Angleton asked.
She killed the brown with a shield? Galston asked.
The questions bounced among those gathered. Responses were words of doubt, statements of disbelief. With each comment, Persephone saw faces looking over at her, as if she were different. Cobb, who spent a good deal of his time shouting from the top of the gate, was heard over everyone else.
Is that true?
The crowd quieted.
It's true.
Malcolm said.
One by one, all the Frey confirmed the truth of Wraith's words. No one thought to question their honesty or eyesight.
Okay, then.
Persephone looked out over the gathered crowd. Anyone wanting to challenge my right to be chieftain, this is your chance.
She waited. Faces turned, looking expectantly at one another.
One of the Tope boys? One of Whedon's sons? She asked. No?
The Dáil was so quiet that they could hear the crickets in the field.
Okay, then. As of this moment, I am the chieftain of Dáil Ren.
The crowd began talking among themselves again, and Persephone held up her hands.
Quiet! Moya shouted. Your chieftain isn't done.
Thank you, Moya, Persephone said.
As chieftain, I have a few things to say. First, if I understood enough of what was said this morning, I fear the Frey among us will not be allowed to live peacefully in exile. As they risked themselves to defend us, I offer them Dáil Ren, not merely as a sanctuary, but as their new home. Our fate and theirs are tied together from here on, for good
or ill.
And that goes for Arion as well. I plan to tell her this when she wakes. We lost many good men last night, and two more this morning. Both hard workers. I insist that as long as the Frey stay with us, they must contribute to the Dáil, and help provide meat for our tables.
She saw Nefron's nod, and replied to him with a smile. Everyone else saw this as well, and the murmurs quieted.
As everyone knows, Maeve is dead. Dáil Réinn is without a keeper of ways. I therefore appoint Brynn, daughter of Delwyn and Sarah, to be the new chronicler of our people.
Moya clapped again, and this time a few others joined her. Pedera and Rhone were the loudest.
Persephone looked to Wraith then, and took a deep breath. I'm also appointing Wraith of Dorea, who has already saved my life more than once, and stood faithfully by my side against certain death, to be my shield, for I can think of no greater or more loyal warrior.
She wondered if she should have asked first, but he didn't say no right away, and so she quickly moved on.
To Malcolm, who also stood his ground with me in battle, and willingly offered to stand and die that I might live.
She extended a hand toward him.
I grant full citizenship in Dáil Réinn. We are short on men in general now, but even if that weren't so, we'd be eager for one with virtues such as yours.
Moya led the applause once more. This time the crowd was getting used to the idea, and Persephone could feel the shift from doubt to confidence. The people before her no longer saw an uncertain sunset, but the coming dawn of possibilities. Persephone pointed over everyone's heads.
For those of you who don't already know, that young woman sitting against the wall with the wolf is Suri. While all of you were asleep in your beds, she set out on a dangerous quest to save your lives. The same quest that took Maeve from this world.
Every head turned.
Suri lifted her face from between her knees and stared back. A moment later, Mina did likewise. To Suri, I bestow the official title of the First Mystic of Réinn, and also designate her as a personal advisor. I'm certain I'll consult with her frequently, mostly because she's the only one I know who can understand the language and wisdom of trees.
This brought another murmur.
Persephone took another breath and brushed hair from her face. I'm afraid what we've seen today isn't over. A storm is coming, I think. A war between the Frey and ourselves. What you witnessed this morning was only the beginning. Suri saw the signs a month ago, and I believe her. A terrible reckoning is still on its way. We, as a people, stand atop a precipice, backed up to the very edge. We have no choice. We must find the courage to fight for our lives, even against those we once thought to be gods. Remember what you've seen today. Draw courage from the fact that even their most powerful die. You've seen that with your own eyes this day.
She pointed to the stone statue in the center of the courtyard.
We of Dáil Réinn worship the goddess Mira, who has saved us from destruction and is clearly more powerful than any Frey. She has delivered unto us the gifts of Wraith, Suri, Nefron, and Arion. My hope is that she'll guide us through any storms in the future, and deliver us to a new world, where we don't need to live every day as if it's our last. A brighter tomorrow awaits us, for we'll live in a new age free of false gods, where we can decide our own destiny.
The crowd applauded its approval, and Persephone took that moment to enter the lodge that was once again her home.
The eternal fire was out. Only a few coals still glowed. She grabbed some pieces of split wood from the pile and worked them in, then blew. Smoke rose. Persephone blew again, and the flame flickered. She tossed another log on. When she was satisfied the fire had caught, she walked over to the center of the hall and sat in the first chair.
"That's a pathetic-looking spear," Nephron said, approaching Malcolm where he stood on the wall near the gate. Being an official member of Clan Wren, Malcolm had volunteered to take the watch that night. After such a harrowing day, everyone else was asleep, the fires long out. Only the full moon looked down, revealing the walkway.
"I call it Nasirabad."
"Cute," Nephron said. Then, switching to Frey, he added, "You've been avoiding me.
It's been a long day."
"And before?"
"I've been here for more than a week. Why is this the first time we've spoken together? And why is it me coming to you and not the other way around?"
This time Malcolm replied in Frey,
"I didn't think it would be in either of our best interests to be seen together.
And I think you're growing a bit too fond of life outside the wrist. Perhaps a taste of freedom has given you an appetite for more. Were you planning on running away?"
Nephron asked. "Is that why you volunteered to watch the gate?"
Nephron didn't give Malcolm a chance to answer. He walked past him along the rampart, his eyes peering out into the darkness to the northwest. When he spoke, it was in runic.
"When I was young, that out there was my playground. Avrilin was a grand gateway to high adventures. The snow-capped mountains of Hentlan were home to the violent Grenmorians. The jagged teeth of the Edendil Durat hosted the hill goblins. The meadows were rich with game, and the Harwood filled with dark secrets. I bathed in the gold sunsets, wandered beneath the moon, and gleefully accepted every challenge. Even among the Instaria, I'm a legend. A hero."
"Alon Rist had been a hero," Malcolm reminded him. "So had a teller. The stories all end the same."
Nephron took a step closer to Malcolm and leaned in, placing a hand on top of the one the ex-slave was using to hold Nasirabad. He whispered in Frey, "I thought I told you to kill Shigan."
Malcolm replied with a guilty, uncomfortable smile.
"I sent you with him for that specific reason. Did you forget? Imagine my surprise when I discovered Wraith, instead of my slave, is the God Killer."
"I'm not your slave. I belong to your father."
"I'm sorry, didn't you hear the news? He's dead.
That makes you my property."
"I'm not sure slavery is one of Ferrol's laws."
Nephron laughed softly and licked his lips. "You of all people know I'm not a stickler for rules.
But not even your father saw me as his slave."
"My father wasn't all that bright, as evidenced by his death. Now, do you want to explain your memory lapse? How is it that Wraith is the one who killed Shigan? Why wasn't it you?"
"Two reasons," Malcolm said. "First, as you just pointed out, many would see me as your property, and that would link you to Shigan's murder. You don't want that."
"A risk I was willing to take."
"And second, I suspected that when Merrill and I returned, pointing fingers at each other, you'd have us both executed. And that wasn't a risk I was willing to take."
Nephron pursed his lips and nodded.
Very clever of you.
And you're right. But I'm not sure how I feel about that.
I don't think anyone has outwitted me before. Makes me nervous.
Given what you're planning, I think you ought to be nervous, don't you?
Nephron shook his head. No. All that I've done, and will do, was predestined. Ordained by God.
Malcolm raised a skeptical eyebrow. Really? Which one?
Nephron offered a mischievous grin. I haven't decided.
The End.
This is Tim Gerard Reynolds. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Age of Myth by Michael J. Sullivan. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Read on for a sneak peek at Age of Swords, Book 2 of The Legends of the First Empire. We hope you have enjoyed Age of Myth, the first book in the Legends of the First Empire series. We're pleased to present you with a sneak peek of the second book, Age of Swords, releasing in the summer of 2017. Enjoy. Chapter 1. Broken. Most people believe the first battle of the Great War occurred at Granford in the autumn. But the truth is, it started 3 months before, on a beautiful summer's day, in Dol Ren. The Book of Bryn. Giffert knew he would never win a foot race. He was late coming to this realization. Everyone else knew it the day he was born. His left leg didn't have much feeling, couldn't support his weight, and dragged. His back wasn't much better. Badly twisted, it forced his hips one direction, and his shoulders another. For years he held out hope he'd get better. He'd believed that if he tried hard enough, long enough, he could straighten up and stand on 2 feet. It never happened. But his leg and back weren't the worst of it. Gifford was cursed with only half a face. He had the other half, exactly where it ought to be, but like his leg, it, too, was useless. The left side didn't move at all, making it difficult to see and torturous to talk. But his face wasn't the worst of it. When he was 8, Gavin Killian had dubbed him the Goblin, and Myrtus, the brewmaster's daughter, said he was broken. Of the two, he preferred Goblin. At the time, he'd had a crush on Myrtus. When growing up, it seemed everyone had called him something, none complimentary. Over the years, the names faded. No one called him the Goblin anymore, and although people probably still thought he was broken, no one said it. At least not to his face. But the name-calling wasn't the worst of it. He had trouble controlling his bladder. The accidents occurred mostly at night, and he frequently woke in a soaked bed. For most of his life, his morning baths had been the worst of it. Yet as with all his other adversities, he'd found a way to cope, a way to persevere. He drank sparingly, and never at night. Even on the coldest winter nights, when the villagers of Dol Ren huddled together in the main lodge for warmth, he always slept alone, which was easier than he would have liked. Although Gifford's roads appeared narrower, rockier, and strewn with more thorns than others, he always found a way to deal with life's setbacks. Nothing came easy, but Giffert refused to see himself as a victim. He was alive, generally happy, and people loved and praised the pottery he created. That was more than many people had, and more than enough to satisfy Gifford. And yet whenever he looked at Rowan, he knew the worst of it, the worst part of being him, was that the only thing he truly wanted was forever beyond the reach of his feeble body, and no amount of positive thinking would change that. Rowan lashed the wood and tin contraption to his left leg, tightening the leather straps. She knelt before him, wearing her work apron, a smudge of charcoal on the side of her nose. Her hair was pulled back in a short ponytail, which was so high on her head that it looked like a rooster's crest. Her clever little hands were marred by dozens of cuts from working with sharp metal. He wanted to hold them, kiss the wounds, and take the pain away. He'd tried once, and it hadn't gone well. She'd pulled away, her eyes wide with fear and a look of horror on her face. Rowan had an aversion to being touched, and not just by him, thank Mera. Mountains of praise for his beautiful cups and amphorae wouldn't have been able to offset the anguish if her reaction had been limited to him. Rowan yanked hard on the ankle strap and nodded with a firm, determined expression. "That should do it." She stood up and dusted her clean hands, symbolically. Rowan's voice was eager but serious. "Ready?" Gifford answered by pulling himself up with the aid of his crafting table. The device on his leg, comprised of wooden planks and metal hinges, squeaked as he rose, making a sound like the opening of a tiny door. "Do you have your weight on it?" she asked. "Put your weight on it. See if it holds." For Gifford, putting weight on his left leg was akin to leaning on water. But for Rowan, he'd willingly fall on his face. Perhaps he could manage a roll and make her smile. She rarely smiled, and never laughed. If only he'd been born with two stout legs, strong and agile, he'd dance and twirl like a fool and make her smile, make her laugh. Giffert would show Rowan what he saw when he looked at her, but, broken as he was, the twisted potter made a poor mirror and could only cast back a shattered reflection. Giffert tilted his hips, and out of faith and love, shifted some weight to his left leg. He didn't fall. A strain tugged on the straps wrapped around his thigh and calf, but his leg held. His mouth dropped open, his eyes widened, and he saw Rowan grin.
"By Mara, what an amazing sight!"
He couldn't help smiling back. He was standing straight, or as straight as his gnarled back allowed. He was winning an impossible battle using magic armor Rowan had fashioned.
"Take a step," she coaxed.
Both hands were clenched in fists, as if she were hanging on to something invisible in front of her. Gifford shifted his weight back to his right side and lifted his left leg. Swinging forward, it squeaked again. He leaned and took a step the way normal people had done a million times. The moment he did, the brace collapsed.
"Oh, no!"
Rowan gasped as Gifford fell face first, barely missing the set of newly glazed cups drying in the morning sun. His cheek and ear slapped the dirt, jarring his head. His elbow, hand, and hip took most of the punishment. To Rowan it must have looked painful, but Gifford was used to falling. He'd been doing it all his life.
"I'm so sorry."
Rowan was back on her knees, bent over him as he rolled to his side. Her grin was gone, and the world less bright. He couldn't help feeling it was his fault.
"I'm okay. No problem," he said. "I missed the cups."
"The hinge failed."
She struggled to hold back the tears as her injured hand ran over the brace.
"How many cuts came from building that brace for me?"
"The strut bent," she said.
"The copper just isn't strong enough.
I'm so sorry."
"It's held for a while,"
he said to cheer her up.
"Keep at it. You'll make it work. I know you will."
"There's an additional force when you walk. I need to account for the forward motion and the additional weight when your other leg is raised."
She slapped the side of her head several times, eyes flinching with each blow.
"I should have realized that. I should have. How could I not?"
He instinctively grabbed her wrist to prevent additional blows.
"Don't do—"
Rowan screamed and jerked away, drawing back in terror. When she'd recovered, they exchanged embarrassed looks, mirroring each other. The moment dragged unpleasantly until Gifford forced a smile. He didn't feel like smiling. He wanted to crawl into a hole and weep. But he donned the expression the same way he forced himself to get up each morning and greet a world that wasn't meant for him. The smile wasn't one of his best, but it was the best he could manage, and whether Rowan knew it or not, he offered it out of love. To ease past the uncomfortable pause, he picked up their conversation where it had left off, pretending nothing had happened.
"How could you know something that's not been done before, Rowan?"
She blinked at him twice, then shifted her focus. She wasn't looking at anything in particular, she was thinking. Sometimes Rowan thought so intensely that he could almost hear it. She blinked again and emerged from the stupor. Rowan walked over to Gifford's craft table and picked up one of his cups. The awkward moment had vanished, as if it had never existed.
"This design is new, isn't it?" she asked. "Do you think it could hold its shape for a much larger size? If we could find a way to—"
Gifford's smile turned genuine.
"Has anyone told you? You a genius, Rowan?"
She nodded, a little rooster crest whipping.
"You have."
"Because it's true," he said.
She looked embarrassed again, the way she always did when he complimented her, the way she looked when anyone said something nice, but it was a familiar unease. Her eyes shifted back to the brace, and she sighed.
"I need something stronger. Can't make it out of stone. Can't make it out of wood."
"I wouldn't suggest clay,"
he said, pushing his luck by trying to be funny.
"Though I would have made you a beautiful hinge."
"I know you would,"
she said, in complete seriousness. Rowan wasn't one for jokes. Much of humour arose from the unexpected or absurd, like making a hinge out of clay. But Rowan's mind didn't work that way. To Rowan, nothing was too absurd, and no idea was too crazy.
"I'll just have to think of something," she said, and started unbuckling the brace. "Some way to strengthen the metal. There's always a better way. That's what Padera said, and she's always right."
The wind gusted and blew Gifford's clothes from the crafting table. Two cups fell over with a delicate clink. Thick, voluminous clouds rolled in, blotting out the blue and blanketing the sun. Around the doll, people urgently trotted toward their homes.
"Get the wash in! Get the wash in!"
Viv Baker yelled at her daughter. The Killian boys raced after chickens, and Bergen rushed to shut down his new batch of beer, cursing as he did. "Perfect blessed day a minute ago," he grumbled, peering up at the sky as if it could hear him. Rowan glanced at the cups and bowls scattered around the craft table. Gifford had been having a productive day before Rowan stopped by, but he was grateful for the distraction.
"You need to get your work inside."
She redoubled her efforts to remove the brace, but was having trouble with one of the buckles.
"Made this one too tight."
The wind grew stronger. The banners on the lodge were cracking with sharp report. The fire braziers near the well struggled to stay lit, but lost their battle. Both were snuffed out.
"That's not good," Gifford said. "I've only seen them blow out once. That was when the top came off the lodge."
Another gust made his whole set of cups ring together. Two more toppled, rolling on their sides and making half circles on the tabletop. The thatch on his little house rustled. Still on the ground, Gifford felt dirt and grass hitting his face and arms. Rowan, frustrated with the buckle, reached into one of her two new pockets. She pulled out her snips and cut the leather straps, freeing him.
"There. Now we can—"
Lightning struck the lodge. Splinters, sparks, and a plume of white smoke were followed by a clap so loud that Gifford felt it pass through him. Thunder rolled like an angry growl. One section of the lodge's roof had sheared off, giant logs split, and the thatch had caught fire.
"Did you see—"
Gifford started to say, when another bolt of lightning struck the other side of the lodge.
"Whoa!"
He and Rowan stared in shock as a third and then a fourth bolt pelted the log building. Cobb and Bergen were the first to react, and the two ran for the well, picking up water gourds on their way. Then another clap of lightning hit the well's windlass, bursting the pole in a cloud of splinters. Both men hit the ground. More bolts of lightning rained down, both inside and outside the dull. With each blast came screams, fire, and smoke. All around them, people ran to their homes. The Galantians, Frey warriors who had been welcomed to the Dáil when exiled, came out of their tents and stared up at the sky. They looked just as scared as everyone else, which was as disturbing as the cataclysmic storm. Until recently, runes had thought Frey were indestructible gods. Gelston, the shepherd, ran past. While making his way between the new woodpile and the patch of near-ripe beans in the Killian's garden, he became struck. Gifford didn't see much, just a snaking, blinding brilliance. When his sight returned, Gelston was on the ground, his hair on fire. Gifford shouted to Rowan,
"We need to get to the stowage pits! White, now!"
He pushed himself up with his crutch and started hopping toward the storehouses.
"Rowan! Gifford!"
Wraith and Malcolm ran up. Wraith still carried his two swords, the broken copper slung on his back and the Frey blade hanging naked from his belt. Malcolm held his spear with both hands.
"Do you know where Persephone is?"
Gifford shook his head.
"But we need to get to the pits."
Wraith nodded.
"I'll spread the word. Malcolm, help them."
Malcolm moved to Gifford's side and put his shoulder under the potter's arm. He mostly carried Gifford to the big storage pit, while Rowan followed close behind. With the first harvest still more than a month away, the pits were nearly empty. Lined in mud brick, the hole retained the smell of musty vegetables, grain and straw. Other members of the Dáil were already there, the bakers and their two boys and one daughter huddled against the back wall, eyes wide. Engleton and Farmer Whedon peered out the open door at the violence of the storm. Bryn, the Dáil's newly appointed Keeper of Ways, was there as well, but she seemed to be on her way out,
Have you seen my parents? Bryn shouted the moment she saw them. No, Rowan replied.
Outside, the thunder cracked and rolled continually. Gifford could only imagine the lightning strikes that accompanied them. Being down in the pit, he couldn't see the yard, just a small square of sky. Bryn started to bolt from the pit. The young girl sprang like a fawn, but Gifford had anticipated her dash. Unlike the crippled Potter, Bryn could win a foot race, and was easily the fastest person on the doll. The 15-year-old girl regularly won all the sprints during the Summer Rules Festival, but Gifford caught her by the arm.
"Let me go!" She pulled and jerked. "I need to find my parents."
"It's too dangerous."
"I don't care."
Bryn jerked hard, so hard she fell, but Gifford still hung on.
"Let me go."
Gifford's legs, even his good one, were mostly useless, and his lips slid down the side of his face because he didn't have enough muscle to support them. But he relied on his arms and hands for everything. Thurgin and Cryer, who had always picked on him, once made the mistake of challenging Gifford to a hand-squeezing contest. He had humiliated Cryer, making him cry. His name only made the embarrassment worse. Thurgin was determined not to suffer a similar fate, and cheated by using both hands. Gifford had held back with Cryer, but didn't see the need with a cheater. He broke Thurgin's little finger and the tiny bone that ran from his fourth knuckle to his wrist. There was no possibility that Bryn would break free. Autumn, Fig, and Tressa tumbled through the door, all of them exhausted and out of breath. Keith Coswall, the Killians, and Filson the Lampmaker came through just after. They dragged Gelston, who remained unconscious, his hair mostly gone, but no longer on fire. Bergen followed them, covered in dirt and grass. He reported that the lodge was burning like a harvest moon bonfire.
"Has anyone seen my parents?" Bryn shouted.
No one had. As if the wind and lightning weren't enough, hail began to fall. Apple-sized chunks of ice clattered, leaving craters in the turf where they impacted. More people raced into the shelter of the granary, running with arms, pots, and boards over their heads. They filed to the back, crying and hugging each other. Bryn watched them come in, always looking but not finding the faces she sought. Finally, the fray, with shields protecting their heads, charged in along with Moya, Cobb, and Habit.
"Where's my mother?"
Bryn pleaded. Once again, the girl charged for the door. This time, Moya assisted Gifford by catching her as well.
"You can't," Moya said, her hair a wild mess. "Your house is burning. There's nothing..."
Outside, a roar grew like the angry growl of a colossal beast. Everyone stared out the doorway, as the sky grew darker still, and the wind blew with even more force. Then, as everyone watched, the baker's roundhouse was ripped apart. First the thatch was blown away, then the wood beams were ripped free, and finally the walls succumbed. They didn't fall. The logs were sucked into the air. Then the foundation of mud bricks was sheared and scattered. After that, the entire world outside the storage pit was lost to a whirlwind cloud of dirt and debris.
"Close the door," Nephron ordered.
Grigor, the giant, started to haul it shut just as Wraith arrived.
"Has anyone seen Persephone?"
"She's gone.
Went to the forest,"
Moya shouted, as she grabbed and pulled him in. Grigor slammed the door closed.
"No!" Bryn screamed. "My parents are still out there!"
Gifford let go of her then, and the girl fell to her knees, weeping. Wraith drew close to Moya.
Did Serf really go into the forest?
Moya nodded.
Her, Suri, and Arion, they went to that oak tree again to ask it more questions.
That's on top of a big hill, up in the open glade, he said to nobody in particular. Wraith looked like he might be sick. There had been rumors that the Dorian was in love with their chieftain, but then a lot of recent rumors had turned out to be untrue. Seeing Wraith's face, Gifford lacked any doubt. If Rowan was still outside, he would have looked the same way. They all sat or knelt in tearful silence as the roaring grew louder. All around Gifford, people quivered, whimpered, and stared at the dark ceiling, no doubt wondering if it would rip away or cave in and bury them. He stood beside Rowan, the weight of the crowd pressing them together.
It was the closest he'd ever been to her. Gifford could feel her warmth and smell the scents of charcoal, oil and smoke, the smells he'd come to associate with Rowan, and all things good. If the roof collapsed and killed everyone, Gifford would have thanked Mera for that final kindness.
The granary was little more than a hole in the ground, but given that it protected the doll's food supply, the pit was solidly built to withstand just about anything. The best wood and rock went into its construction. The walls were dirt and stone, the ceiling braced by logs driven into the ground. This was the place where most of Gifford's work ended up. Harvests of barley, wheat, and rye were poured into huge clay urns he had made. The tops were sealed with wax to keep out the mice and moisture. The granary also shielded wine, honey, oil, vegetables, and a cache of smoked meats. After the long winter, most of the stores were gone, and the pit was little more than a hole. But it was a sturdy one. Still, the ceiling shook, and the door rattled. The only bit of light that continued to enter the bin was through the narrow slit where the door didn't precisely meet its frame. This sliver of white flickered violently.
"It'll be okay,"
Gifford told Rowan. He said it in a whisper, as if it were a secret he'd chosen to share with her alone. Bryn, Viv Baker, and her daughter Hest were crying loudly. And it wasn't just the women. Cobb, Heath Coswell, Habit and Filson wept openly as well. But Rowan wasn't like them. She wasn't like anyone, and that was why he liked her. When she turned to look at him, the light from the door highlighted the contour of her face. She wasn't crying, and didn't look scared. There was just an intensity in her eyes. If there weren't a dozen people between Rowan and the door, if she were alone in the dark, he had no doubt she would have gone outside. She wanted to see. Rowan wanted to see everything. The clatter of hail stopped, but rain fell in bands. Hard at times, then lighter, only to pound once more. The howl of the wind faded. Even the cracks of lightning fell silent. Finally, the light from the door became bright and unwavering. Nephron shoved the door open and crept out. A moment later he waved for them to follow. Everyone squinted against the brightness of the sun, struggling to see. Thatch and logs were scattered everywhere. Branches, leaves, and broken planks of wood littered the yard. One of the lodge's banners lay on the ground, its ends frayed. Not a single roundhouse had survived. The breath of the doll was a vacant field of mangled dirt and debris, surrounded by the still intact wall. All that remained were bare spots where grass hadn't grown, and a score of fire pits that continued to smolder. Overhead, clouds were breaking up, and Giff had already spotted patches of blue.
"Is it over?"
Heath Coswall asked from the back. As if in answer, a loud boom sounded, and the doll's front gate trembled.
"What is that?"
Moya asked, speaking for everyone. Another bang hit, and the gate began to buckle.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.